You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. We've had the distinct pleasure of presenting, welcoming Colson Whitehead three times over the last decades as part of Aloud. The MacArthur Award-winning author spoke to us for his coming-of-age novel, Sag Harbor, for his zombie thriller, Zone One, for The Noble Hustle, his hilarious account of competing in the World Series of Poker, and he's also the author of two other superb novels, The Intuitionist and John Henry Days. Tonight, we celebrate Colson's newest novel, The Underground Railroad, a book that's been electrifying readers across the country. It's number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a work that Whitehead refers to as, quote, the one that really scared him. The Underground Railroad is the chronicle of an odyssey, not just through geography, but through time, as we follow the runaway slave Cora on her harrowing flight north through a landscape both familiar and unfamiliar. It's both an adventure tale and a meditation on our shared history. Some of you may have seen in the New York Times this morning a feature on the impending opening of the new Museum of African American History on the Mall in Washington, D.C. President Obama will speak at the dedication next week. And I was looking at those amazing photographs of what's in the museum. And among the many poignant and repugnant, truly repugnant objects in that museum of history, which we all share, is a slave auction block from Hagerstown, Maryland. It was moved to the museum, it says, from a street corner where it sat, quote, on a small patch of grass in front of a gas station. And as Colson Whitehead makes so clear in his brilliant new novel, the racism of the past is still here in the present, but also his protagonist, Cora, discovers that the contours of a new nation are hidden beneath the old. I'm delighted tonight to welcome Joy Press as our interlocutor for Colson. Joy is the former book and culture editor of the Los Angeles Times and the Village Voice, where she and Colson first crossed paths. She's currently writing a book about the history of women and television. And before Joy and Colson come on stage for their conversation, we have a special treat tonight. Phil LaMarr, an original cast member of Mad TV and alumnus of The Groundlings, who appears regularly on this season in HBO's Veep and in the Black Version improv comedy show at Largo, is going to perform a dramatic reading from The Underground Railroad. And I want to thank Attica Locke, our Library Foundation board member and wonderful author, for introducing us to Phil. So please, let's begin this evening. Please welcome Phil LaMarr.
The music stopped. The circle broke. Sometimes a slave will be lost in a brief eddy of liberation, in the sway of a sudden reverie among the furrows, or while untangling the mysteries of an early morning dream, in the middle of a song on a warm Sunday night. Then it comes, always, the overseer's cry, the call to work, the shadow of the master, the reminder that she is only a human being for a tiny moment across the eternity of her servitude. The Randall brothers had emerged from the great house and were among them. The slaves stepped aside, making calculations of what distance represented the right proportion of fear and respect. Godfrey, James's houseboy, held up a lantern. According to old Abraham, James favored the mother, stout as a barrel and just as firm in countenance, and Terence took after the father, tall and owl-faced, perpetually on the verge of swooping down on prey. In addition to the land, they inherited their father's tailor, who arrived once a month in his rickety carriage with his samples of linen and cotton. The brothers dressed alike when they were children and continued to do so in manhood. Their white trousers and shirts were as clean as the laundry girl's hands could make them, and the orange glow made the men look like ghosts emerging from the dark. "Master James," Jockey said. His good hand gripped the arm of his chair as if to rise, but he did not stir. "Master Terence."
"Don't let us disturb you," Terence said. "My brother and I were discussing business and heard the music. I told him, now that is the most god-awful racket I've ever heard."
The Randalls were drinking wine out of goblets of cut glass and looked as if they had drained a few bottles. Cora searched for Caesar's face in the crowd. She did not find him. He hadn't been present the last time the brothers appeared together on the northern half. You did well to remember the different lessons of those occasions. Something always happened when the Randalls ventured into the quarter, sooner or later. A new thing coming that you couldn't predict until it was upon you. James left the daily operations to his man Connolly, and rarely visited. He might grant a tour to a visitor, a distinguished neighbor or curious planter from another neck of the woods, but it was rare. James rarely addressed his niggers, who had been taught by the lash to keep working and ignore his presence. When Terence appeared on his brother's plantation, he usually appraised each slave and made a note of which men were the most able and which women the most appealing. Content to leer at his brother's women, he grazed heartily upon the women of his own half. "I like to taste my plums," Terence said, prowling the rows of cabins to see what struck his fancy. He violated the bonds of affection, sometimes visiting slaves on their wedding night to show the husband the proper way to discharge his marital duty. He tasted his plums and broke the skin and left his mark. It was accepted that James was of a different orientation. Unlike his father and brother, James did not use his property to gratify himself. Occasionally, he had women from the county to dine, and Alice was always sure to make the most sumptuous, seductive supper at her means. Mrs. Randall had passed many years before, and it was Alice's thought that a woman would be a civilizing presence on the plantation. For months at a time, James entertained these pale creatures, their white buggies traversing the mud tracks that led to the great house. The kitchen girls giggled and speculated, and then a new woman would appear. To hear his valet prideful tell it, James confined his erotic energies to specialized rooms in a New Orleans establishment. The madam was broad-minded and modern, adept in the trajectories of human desire. Prideful's stories were hard to believe, despite assurances that he received his reports from the staff of the place, with whom he'd grown close over the years. What kind of white man would willingly submit to the whip? Terence scratched his cane in the dirt. It had been his father's cane, topped with a silver wolf's head. Many remembered its bite on their flesh.
"Then I recollected James telling me about a nigger he had down here," Terence said. "Could recite the Declaration of Independence. I can't bring myself to believe him. I thought perhaps tonight he can show me, since everyone is out and about from the sound of it."
"We'll settle it," James said. "Where is that boy, Michael?" No one said anything. Godfrey waved the lantern around pathetically. Moses was the boss unfortunate enough to stand closest to the Randall brothers. He cleared his throat.
"Michael did, Master James."
Moses instructed one of the pickaninnies to fetch Connolly, even if it meant interrupting the overseer from his Sunday evening concubinage. The expression on James's face told Moses to start explaining. Michael, the slave in question, had indeed possessed the ability to recite long passages. According to Connolly, who heard the story from the nigger trader, Michael's former master was fascinated by the abilities of South American parrots and reasoned that if a bird could be taught limericks, a slave might be taught to remember as well. Merely glancing at the size of the skulls told you that a nigger possessed a bigger brain than a bird. Michael had been the son of his master's coachman, had a brand of animal cleverness, the kind you see in pigs sometimes. The master and his unlikely pupil started with simple rhymes and short passages from popular British versifiers. They went slow over the words the nigger didn't understand, and if truth be told, the master only half understood. As his tutor had been a reprobate who had been chased from every decent position he had ever held and who decided to make his final posting the canvas for his secret revenge. They made miracles, the tobacco farmer and the coachman's son. The Declaration of Independence was their masterpiece, a history of repeated injuries and usurpations. Michael's ability never amounted to more than a parlor trick, delighting visitors before the discussion turned, as it always did, to the diminished faculties of niggers. His owner grew bored and sold the boy south.
By the time Michael got to Randall, some torture or punishment had addled his senses. He was a mediocre worker. He complained of noises and black spells that blotted his memory. In exasperation, Connolly beat out what little brains he had left. It was a scourging that Michael was not intended to survive, and it achieved its purpose. "I should have been told," James said, his displeasure plain. Michael's recitation had been a novel diversion the two times he trotted the nigger out for guests. Terence liked to tease his brother. "James," he said, "you need to keep better account of your property." "Don't meddle. I knew you let your slaves have revels, but I had no idea they were so extravagant. You trying to make me look bad?" "Don't pretend you care what a nigger thinks of you, Terence." James's glass was empty. He turned to go.
"One more song, James. These sounds have grown on me."
George and Wesley were forlorn. Noble in his tambourine was nowhere to be seen. James pressed his lips into a slit. He gestured, and the men started playing. Terence tapped his cane. His face sank as he took in the crowd.
"You're not gonna dance? I have to insist. You and you."
They didn't wait for their master's signal. The slaves of the northern half converged on the alley, haltingly, trying to insinuate themselves into their previous rhythm and put on a show. Crooked Ava had not lost her power to dissemble since her days of harassing Cora. She hooted and stomped as if it were the height of the Christmas celebrations. Putting on a show for the master was a familiar skill. The small angles and advantages of the mask. And they shook off their fear as they settled into the performance. Oh, how they capered and hollered, shouted and hopped. Certainly this was the most lively song they had ever heard. The musicians, the most accomplished players the colored race had to offer. Cora dragged herself into the circle, checking the Randall's brothers' reactions on every turn like everyone else. Jockey tumbled his hands in his lap to keep time. Cora found Caesar's face. He stood in the shadow of the kitchen, his expression flat. Then he withdrew.
"You!"
It was Terence. He held his hand before him as if it were covered in some eternal stain that only he could see. Then Cora caught sight of it, the single drop of wine staining the cuff of his lovely white shirt. Chester had bumped him. Chester simpered and bowed down before the white man.
"Sorry, master. Sorry, master."
The cane crashed across his shoulder and head again and again. The boy screamed and shrank to the dirt as the blows continued. Terence's arm rose and fell. James looked tired. One drop. A feeling settled over Cora. She had not been under its spell in years, since she brought the hatchet down on Blake's doghouse and sent the splinters into the air. She had seen men hung from trees and left for buzzards and crows. Women carved open to the bones with the cat of nine tails. Bodies alive and dead roasted on pyres. Feet cut off to prevent escape and hands cut off to stop theft. She had seen boys and girls younger than this beaten and had done nothing. This night, the feeling settled on her heart again. It grabbed hold of her before the slave part of her caught up with the human part of her. She was bent over the boy's body as a shield. She held the cane in her hand like a swamp man handling a snake and saw the ornament at its tip. The silver wolf bared its silver teeth. Then the cane was out of her hand. It came down on her head. It crashed down again, and this time the silver teeth ripped across her eyes and her blood splattered the dirt.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks, Coulson. I will say that I fell in love with Underground Railroad, as I'm sure many of you have who have read it. It is panoramic but specific. It's hard to bear. Hard to bear, but also hard to put down. And I have been reading Coulson's work since before he started publishing books. Uh-huh. We worked together back in the day at the Village Voice, and at the time, Coulson was a book critic and a TV critic and a music critic. And you have gone on to write this sort of amazing array of books, a detective novel about an elevator inspector, a zombie novel, a coming-of-age novel, a memoir about a poker tournament, and even when you were writing about African-American history, and it's something like John Henry Days, you know, it was at least partly from the perspective of a journalist who was sort of pop culture obsessed.
Sure.
So, I mean, it feels like your work has long been kind of steeped in irony and pop culture, and it's been very funny. So, you know, and now you've written this beautiful, very unironic novel about a teenage girl, Cora, who we just met a little bit in that excerpt, who's born into bondage on a Georgia plantation, and you write about the atrocities that she experiences on that plantation, and sort of on her journey across America via the Underground Railroad. So, I, you know, what drew you to this subject matter and to this approach? I mean, Louise mentioned that you talked about it as your hard book.
Surely, yeah. Before I start, I'd like to thank Alaa for having me back again, and all you nice people for coming out. It's such a nice room. Usually there's someone like in the corner when I'm reading on the nod and like, or smoking crack or something. And then Phil has such a nice reading. You know, I've tried to do like the slave master voice, but it always sounds like Foghorn Leghorn. Like, I say, Brother Terrence, you know, so thanks so much for making my words sound really good. I first had the idea 16 years ago. I was winding down on John Henry Days, which had a lot of historical bits in it. It takes place in 96, but moves around in time a lot. And I think I was just laying on my couch and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad and thought about how when I was in fourth grade, I would hear about it and immediately envision a literal subway beneath America. And then, of course, your teacher, if you have a good teacher, tells you the whole story and you realize it's more of a social apparatus and not a literal network underground. But I thought, what if it actually was a literal train? And that's a premise, not so much of a story. So I think really quickly after that, I added the sort of complicating thing of having each state our protagonist goes through as he or she goes north. And for a long time, the protagonist was a dude. As he goes from South Carolina to North Carolina and so on, each state is a different state of American possibility, showing what might have been, or a different American culture. And I guess the natural comparison is to Gulliver's Travels, going from island to island and casting a different perspective on British history in that book and then American history in this one. And that was a long time ago. I didn't feel ready. I felt at age 30, I was kind of a Gen X layabout. I was writing, I'm really happy about the stuff I was writing, but I didn't feel I had the maturity to do the idea justice. And every couple of years, whenever I finished a book, I would pull out my notes, just like the one page of white supremacist state, ? And realized I wasn't up to the task, and then that kept going on for years and years. And then finally, 2.5 years ago, I'd finished the book about poker and had sold a book to my editor. And I wasn't sure if it was the right project, so I told my wife and about the book. And, you know, in your marriage, you have to make conversations sometimes, so I told her about it. Past the time. And she said, well, I don't want to say that your idea about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis is dumb per se, but this Underground Railroad book sounds pretty good. So I was like, huh. And then I went to my agent, who I've had for 18 years, and she was very supportive. of both ideas. And I told my editor about it, and he said go for it, and that was the final thing. So.
I was going to ask whether Cora was always your central character, and it sounds like she wasn't. I mean, she's such a, to have a teenage girl, I mean, such a vulnerable protagonist. At what point did you fasten on her?
I had a string of male protagonists that were sort of ironic and detached, and so it seemed to mix it up might be good, like a good challenge. Originally, it was a man running from the plantation to find a child, to find a spouse that had been sold off, and then I was thinking about the great slave narrative of Harriet Jacobs, who was a woman in North Carolina, and she ran away from her master and hid 7 years in an attic until she could get passage out of North Carolina. So I read that narrative in college, and it always stayed with me. So it seemed the very different state of a female slave would be a good challenge. When you hit 14 as a woman in a slave system, you're supposed to start producing babies. Babies are more hands to pick more cotton. More cotton means more money. More babies means more slaves to sell. And that dynamic seemed compelling to narrate. And I hadn't really tackled a mother-daughter relationship before in my fiction, so wanted to do the hard thing and try and tackle that.
You mentioned Harriet Jacobs, Incidents of a Slave Life, I think is what it's called.
The Life of a Slave Girl.
Life
yeah.
of a Slave. What other kind of research did you do? Did you really sort of dig in before you started?
Sure. I mean, I don't like leaving the house, so luckily everything is in the public domain and downloadable to your iPad. When I was doing an interview a month ago, they were like, do you have any materials that were cool that we could photograph? And I was like, I have my Steve Jobs iPad. It's all in there. I just downloaded it. So the big slave narratives are digitized. And in the 1930s, FDR, trying to get people back to work, hired writers through the Works Progress Administration to interview former slaves, people who were kids and teens at the time of the Civil War, and there are hundreds of these accounts that the writers collected, and some of them are just two paragraphs long, some are two pages, some are 10 pages, but they really reveal the variety of slave experience. You could be a single slave working for a family in a Baltimore townhouse. You could be one of two slaves on a small family farm in North Carolina, or in that plantation we know from pop culture, the 100-person plantation. And that sort of freed me up to come up with my own concoction.
Were there any, specific details that you came across that really, I don't know, particularly shocked you or that really catalyzed a sort of a revelation in terms of
writing? Well, the first day I was reading the WPA narratives, a woman mentioned that once a year they would get new wooden shoes. And I associate wooden shoes with like Holland or whatever. But I guess that means that there was a guy who just made wooden shoes for this plantation. And once a year he can expect a big order from this slave master. And the slave is supposed to wear them for a year before they get a new one. And so there are all sorts of weird... pardon me, little things that you don't think about that go into making the slave system work. There were slave bulletins in newspapers that I came across. The University of North Carolina digitized them. And if your slave ran away, you would place an ad to find them in the same way that if your dog Spot ran away, you would put a little flyer in the laundromat. And so there has to be a guy at the newspaper who's like, takes the ads and says like, are you sure you don't want to put any distinguishing characteristics? Like, do they have like a bad limp or something? Are they light-skinned? How do they talk? And the system was just so vast and so complicated that it sucks everything into it, including newspapers and some guy named Joe whose job it is to keep track of the runaway slaves. And so not everything can go in, but I use this slave bulletin. It's definitely is a great source of language. I think Phil's section, there's the verb scourging, and that just meant, you know, beating somebody, but so many slaves used it, you're trying to make a realistic plantation, so what language do they use? And so I kept drawing verbs and nouns and various things from the book, kept a list, and like would figure out what would work when and where, or not at all.
And you actually have some ads, some actual classified ads for runaway slaves. Were those real ads that you...
They're real. I mean, as a writer like me, a ventriloquist and playing with voices and figuring out how people talk, but I couldn't really compete with the ads themselves. They were so terse and contained, you know, someone's whole life in 8 lines. You know, Bessie has a downcast expression, ran away for no reason whatsoever, and of course we know why.
No reason at all.
And, you know, has been seen in the neighborhood of Edmonton with some of the Negroes there. And so even in that one ad, you have Bessie's life in a plantation, but also a community of free blacks nearby. And you know, can they go in and get her or not? Can someone report her? And so there's a whole life in that one paragraph. And so I used 4 actual ones, and then I made up one at the end for Cora. I put her through so much, particularly towards the end there, that I wanted to have a gift from me to her. And it's not in the same voice as the other ones, and it's sort of like me as a person reaching out to her after coming up with various diabolical things for her.
Mm. One of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book was that I think America has such a willful amnesia about that era, which so much so that when Michelle Obama, at the convention speech, talked about the White House being built by slaves, I mean, there was an outcry. People didn't know it, didn't believe it, and there's such a difficulty for I think African Americans to sort of access their own history, both personally and in a larger way. When you were working on this, did you look into your own ancestry at all?
It's funny, it never occurred to me. I know, my grandparents' lives, they passed away before I was born or very young. But I know that some of them came from Virginia and Florida. My grandmother came from Barbados through Ellis Island. But where were they before? Did they live and die in South Carolina, Louisiana? And I knew that my mother's family had one strain at free men and free women who ran taverns in Virginia. And so I was doing interviews, and I guess some of my family was upset that I was like, I don't know that much. So a family historian was like, well, you know, Sally Madden came over, and she was biracial. Put up for adoption, Episcopal Church posted her, had her, you know, found a home for her on James Madison's plantation, working, or I'm not sure how it worked with indentured servants. And it's always like James Madison is never like, it's never like Joe Smith, you know, like, so I'll have to investigate more with the family historian exactly the full story. I just got a text from my sister a couple days ago. I think they're mad that I was talking about, I don't know that much.
Maybe you can get Henry Louis Gates to help. You know?
Sure. I met him once or twice. I'm not Afflecky enough or something. I don't know. We'll see. That was totally accidental. So, I don't know.
You were talking about systems, and a long time ago, an editor at the Village Voice told me a story, which may be apocryphal, that many years ago, you pitched him a story about ice cream trucks and where do ice cream trucks go at night. I don't know if this rings a bell. And he said, Coulson, I want to do a piece about where do ice cream trucks go at night. And the editor said, I said, no, because I know where ice cream trucks go. They go to a parking lot in Queens.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember at the time really just thinking, what a jerk, because I want to read that piece about where ice cream trucks go, because you, I mean, it's something that you do extraordinarily well, is you sort of write about the invisible workings of things and the hierarchies and, you know, whether it's a poker convention or a plantation. So first of all, I want to know if it's true. And second of all, sort of when did you kind of, you know, realize that you were obsessed with those secret inner workings?
Sure. It wasn't at night, but at the end of the season, when, you know, Labor Day comes, where do they go? And I guess they used to go to this one lot. But it seemed like I could squeeze 1,200 words out of that. No. I need the money. So I'm not sure, you know, yeah, I mean, definitely the intuitionist and, you know, various of my books go deep into one sort of micro subject and blow it up. I think partially is being inspired by nonfiction writers from the 70s and 80s. It was voice writers, you know, people like Elvis Mitchell, and who was up there before, and Lisa Kennedy, Robert Christgau, mm-hmm. people worked at the Village Voice, who would write about film one week and then music the next week. And they had so many different interests, and I think, and you know, would put their great expertise on display week to week. And I found, just as a you know high school kid, buy The Voice every Wednesday and then get a sandwich and turn to the back to see who's playing and then read what Christgau has to say about college rock, which is becoming alternative rock, and all, you know. So I was inspired by these interdisciplinary writers at the Voice. My sisters were older, and they would have The Executioner's Song and all these Tom Wolfe books before he went, you know, super conservative. And I would read those, and they were very inspiring. And then reading Marvel Comics in the late 70s and early 80s, and Stephen King. You know, that's an eccentric list of inspiration, but they refer to different parts of my personality. I like making things up in grand, sort of fabulous ways, finding a cool nonfiction subject and exploring it and tinkering it and having fun with it is another great thing, another thing I've always wanted to do. And when the poker thing fell into my lap, I was very excited. So I think I just like writing different registers. And then when you are building a world, whether it's explaining the World Series of Poker or explaining how elevators work, I think I'm drawing from the tools of world building and science fiction and horror. Mm. How do you explain the rules of this science fiction universe? And so I think I internalized that or started thinking about that in the back of my head when I was just a kid.
That's interesting. I mean, I think the world building within this book is extraordinary, and particularly because you, I mean, it is like Gulliver's Travel. I mean, you're going through multiple worlds. So almost each state that Cora goes through, you build an entirely new
world. It's being rebooted every 60 pages because I am explaining the peculiar ecology of South Carolina versus North Carolina. And I think earlier you talked about, you know, how fast it is. I've written books with no plot at all that are relying on voice, and this one, you know, has a strong plot. I think just if you're, you know, the stakes are life or death when you're dealing with running away from the plantation, and so just when you choose the subject and choose a structure, you're going to have a lot of suspense and forward movement. And, you know, in different books where I've had no plot that rely on voice, or books that have a strong linear narrative, you know, I always think if you take away one audience pleasure plot, what are you giving them back in return? And some books have been very voicey, and so maybe there's not a really strong linear story, but hopefully you find the main character in Sag Harbor's perceptions and a way of talking beguiling enough that you don't notice until you're towards the end and nothing has happened, really, you know? And then, you know, with this book.
Yeah.
And then with this book, you know, I knew there was gonna be a lot of forward momentum just because of the structure, and then I wanted to make sure Cora was a compelling person to hang around with.
Well, you did that all. I mean, you have the character, and then you have, thinking about the different worlds that you build. Even within the plantation, there's a hierarchy. I mean, there's a separate little house where the sort of crazy women are kind of relegated, and then you have the world of the slave patrollers, who within each world there are these little hierarchies. And
well, it's fine, not going to like avoid Southern plantation kitsch and camp, and then also make it psychologically interesting and real to me as someone in the 21st century. So in planning the Georgia section, the plantation, I was thinking, well, you have 100 slaves, and generally get a room of 100 people, 10 are great, 10 are terrible, and 80 sort of vacillate between, you know, those two extremes. So, and we have a modern notion of PTSD. Well, the people on the plantation aren't post anything. They're being traumatized daily and have been for their whole lives. So how does that ruin people, and how does that destroy their sense of self and their relationships? And so everyone, all the slaves are destroyed in their own way, and what do you do with someone who just can't work because they've been brutalized so much? What do you do with someone who can work but is just gone and sort of dead in the eyes? And so I came up with the idea of the misfit cabin, the hob cabin, where they put the defective women. They're the strong women, also the people who've been brutalized so much that they can't mix with the rest of the plantation population. So the world building this one was, in that first section, was trying to find a psychologically realistic plantation for me that made sense. And then also, I have had a satirical distance, an ironic distance in some of my books, and I knew going in I wouldn't be able to use it as much, and then as I did more research, I realized that I wouldn't be able to use it at all, you know, particularly, and just wanting to honor my nameless ancestors who died somewhere in the South, and then all the people whose stories I read in the narratives, I wanted to be as realistic in my depiction of a plantation, which means, you know, being very brutal, very, very brutal to everybody, as you sort of heard in the section that Phil read.
Did you go, each state she comes through all of these different experiences, and did you go in knowing that you wanted to address, say, eugenics, or, I mean, there were historical moments that you sort of wanted to incorporate?
Yeah, some of them were there early on, as I, you know, the accumulated thoughts about the book, and some came when I did the research. I think the biggest change over the years was moving from a very fantastic framework to something that is keeps in the slang vocabulary and technology of 1850. For many years, the South Carolina section would take place in the future in a kind of cloud atlas-y, you know, jump into the future where the slaves are being bred in eugenics experiments to be docile house slaves or strong bucks for the, you know, the manual labor. And I think that, you know, that was my sort of mindset 10 years ago, have a broader, fantastic structure for the book. And then I guess I was healed by Garcia Marquez. I reread Owners of Solitude a few months before I started, and I was like, well, maybe if I didn't turn up to like a Spinal Tapian 11, and just kept them on a simmering one setting of magic realism, how would that fit? And so, and so smoothing out all the absurd events and having them sort of presented in a deadpan, matter of fact voice really worked. So when Cora is confronted with a fantastic situation, we don't spend a paragraph finding fake language to describe a building. There's a skyscraper in North Carolina, it's 12 stories. And so when she sees it, it's not like, what is strange structure reaching to sky? You know, The narrator can just say she saw a skyscraper and was astonished. So keeping it matter of fact was a good tactic for violence, but also for the matter for the fantastic things that happened to her.
Mm. I like that, turning it down to Garcia Marquez level one.
We should, yeah, and not a level.
You have had the same editor pretty much your whole writing career, right?
Yeah, there's a woman named Tina Pullman who bought The Intuitionist and John Henry Days, and then she left Doubleday, and Bill Thomas took over, so I've been with him for 6 books. But, you know, usually you move around a lot, and I've been with the same publisher for 18 years, and so whenever I come with something, you know, I think they're very supportive. And I remember the summer of 2009, I was like, Bill, I have this idea. I think it's like Black Hawk Down meets Night Living Dead. And he's like, it sounds great. I hate horror movies and have never seen one. But just do it, and we'll try and sell it when you're done.
He would probably do the ice cream truck book.
He will, yeah, sure. It's 1,200 pages now, yeah. So they're all very supportive and great over there, and I feel very, very fortunate.
Does he encourage you in any particular direction, or he really just...
He's just really just wants to know what's going to be handed in. But with this book, sometimes I... With Zone 1, I think I wanted to replicate the depression of the character, so I didn't show anybody until I was done. Like, my character is in a bunker in this post-apocalyptic hell, and I'm in my office, which is a post-apocalyptic hell. So I'm not going to show anybody until it's done. And then with Sag Harbor, which is more personal and very pop culture heavy, I would finish each chapter and show it to my agent, who's British. And so if I could test out cultural references, and I would send a chapter with like YouTube clips of The Cosby Show and New Coke. New Coke is a big, important plot point in Sag Harbor. And so... I would show each chapter to her and get a response. And then with this book, I showed my agent edited the first 100 pages, and they, while they're always supportive, you know, there's something in their voices and the way they talked about it, and they were like, "Can you hand it in December?" And I was like, "I guess so." But from their reaction, I knew I'd sort of hit upon something, and they were acting differently. I was just like, don't fuck it up from here. You know, the first 100 pages were good. Don't fuck up the last two.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. It's always there.
It's funny. I mean, thinking about, you're talking about the post-apocalyptic scenario. I mean, in a way, it feels like there might actually be something in common with Underground Railroad. I mean, it really is like a horror movie.
No, definitely. I mean, I think in apocalyptic movies or books, there's often the survivors looking for the last human refuge where they can be safe, where they can be free from the giant ants or the radiation or the nuclear cannibals. And so they find it someplace, and that place is messed up, and they find the next one. But they hope that there's one, you know, they're catching that radio signal from Maine, and like maybe it's not a recording, it's a human person. And can they get there? So if you don't have hope, how can you survive in this wasteland? And of course, for a slave, it's the same thing. If you don't believe that there's a place to be free when your whole life has been bound in this dance of brutality, how do you live? You have to believe that there's a place in New York or Canada or Massachusetts where you can be a real human being for once and not an object, which is what a slave is. So how do you animate that on the page, and how do you get into the head of somebody who makes that brave leap? You know, I think you were talking about earlier about people not wanting to think about slavery or face up to it. And I think if you're from the South, a white person from the South, do you want to contemplate that your great-great-great-great-grandfather raped and brutalized people for a living. And then if you're African-American, do you want to think about what happened to your mostly nameless ancestors in some anonymous state? And then would you have the strength to do what people on, what runaway slaves did, what Cora does? We like to think that we would find that courage and that bravery within us. But most people didn't run. They couldn't run. It was too scary. So what would we do in that situation? Would we be the one to take the leap of faith the way people do in apocalyptic literature and the way slaves did, or would we stay behind and die?
And to find a way to give that character some hope and some...
Sure. And of course, you know, she has no idea what freedom is, having never left the plantation. And then in South Carolina, she finds a place. The particular system in South Carolina is that the government is buying up slaves from slave owners and giving them jobs and homes and education in a sort of echo of Great Society programs of the 60s. Programs of social uplift. Then, of course, things, you know, take a sinister turn. But as she moves from South Carolina to North Carolina, her notion of freedom, what freedom is enlarging as she becomes more of a person and less of an object. And, you know, hopefully in these different encounters she has, there are opportunities for her to figure out what the world is, having never read a book or left the plantation, and also to provide places where the reader can be a partner in her exploration to these different notions of freedom and what freedom means.
So in 5 or 10 minutes, we are going to take some questions, and there are some people who are going to be handing out little slips of paper and pencil. If you guys want them, just flag them down, and we'll take a couple questions. But before that, I have to ask you, when this was originally scheduled, I think this was supposed to be your pub date, but that changed because Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like meeting Oprah Coulson?
Well,
did she say, like, you won a book club?
Well, you know, usually the big thing is, like, she calls you, but I was traveling, and so I wasn't available, and I was on a plane, and I looked at my phone, and my agent had called. And usually when she calls me, I fucked something up, I'm in trouble. So I called her back immediately, and she just said, Oprah. And I was on a plane. So I just said, shut the front door, which is like some sitcom-y thing. Of like,
did you actually say that?
Yes. Because I didn't want to curse on the plane. And Oprah can mean many things. It can mean like the magazine or a review. So she said, Oprah's book club, and I said, motherfucker, and people were looking at me, and I had to apologize, but no air marshals took me off. So we went to her house in Southern California to film some interviews and stuff like that, and my wife came, but we couldn't tell anybody because it was a surprise that it had been picked. And so, whereas I'm a writer, no one cares where I'm going if I'm leaving town. Like, no one's like, where are you going? You know, no one cares. My wife, however, is a functioning member of society, and so I had to tell her office mates where she was going, and she was like, it's a family matter, and like, no one wants to, that cuts it off, because no one wants to hear about your family or what's going on, and be forced to display empathy or something. So, so we flew out, and we meet Oprah, and of course, you know, I remember I was in high school when she went from being Chicago to becoming this national figure, and I guess King Syndicate or whoever syndicated her show like bought every single ad on a bus in the city in like 1985 or 86, and it said, everyone loves opera. And I was like, why is it misspelled or, you know? And then it debuted, and then you know that was Oprah. So it was really cool, you know. Definitely my books don't necessarily sound good all the time when you hear them described. Like, it's about elevator inspectors. It's about poker, and your uncle gambled all your life savings on poker and like you hate gambling. So she brings the book to like a larger audience who might think my book sounds stupid. And hopefully they'll like them. So.
You've also had Obama name check your...
Sure. Well, he's a skinny black man with slender wrists and long fingers, so we gotta stick together in our club. And yeah, it's just really exciting what's been happening the last 6 weeks. I try to be depressed, I think about Donald Trump and how we're all gonna die in December if he wins. But then I'm like, you know, Oprah. I'm still gonna vote, but I'm in a pretty good mood lately. Definitely.
Just keep that in your head. Oprah. Yeah, we don't want him to get too big, too swollen ahead. The national book award nomination this week as well.
No, yeah, it's been a very exciting couple of weeks. Yes.
So you're in LA. Your work is very cinematic. I won't ask you what producers you're talking to, but who would be your ideal directors? It could be a team, it could be one, it could be, you know, a whole committee.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, like Wes Anderson meets Ava DuVernay, like...
There's so many talented people in this crazy town. Who could do it?
Oh, now you don't want to offend anyone? It's like that now?
I guess, you know, people are asking, like, who do you want to be Cora, but... as opposed to like 20 years ago when we were both TV critics, and I actually don't know who the young actors are anymore. I'm not mainlining sort of pop culture in the way I used to. So I think, I don't know, I hope if someone buys it and makes them something.
Just something good.
Something good, yeah.
I hear, you know, you're into comic books. I hear they really like superhero movies.
Yes, that's a big thing now. Apparently, I guess periodically I've been asked, like, would you want to write a Marvel comic or, but it seems really hard. Whenever I try to write like a comic book or a screenplay, I work on it for 2 weeks and I'm like, this sucks. I'll just write a novel. I know how to do a novel.
So you can write a 300, you know, page.
Yeah,
novel
there are a few words
slavery.
In a screenplay, but it's like harder. You know, so I'll stick to novels. Yeah.
Are you working on something else? Do you work sort of, are you a serial monogamist with books? Do you work at a couple times?
Yeah, I work on one straight through and don't do anything else. And so I can't be like teaching or have anything else going on. But I take breaks between books. So I hand this book in December. So I have like, I won't work this year. I might start working next spring. I have an idea about it takes place in New York in the 60s. I've been trying to write a contemporary New York book. The Intuitionist takes place in New York, that's sort of off to the side. And then Zone One is a utopian New York, because everyone's dead, so no one bothers you. And there's no like line for anything. And then I tried to do that Brooklyn Writer book, and my wife was like, that sounds stupid. So Harlem in the 60s sounds... Maybe I can't write about contemporary New York, but I can write about it in the past.
Well, now you've mentioned it, you have to write it.
Yes, I'm bound.
We're gonna hold you to it. How do you know when you're done with a book? I mean, was it really clear to you, or was it something that, I mean, it was marinating for a long time?
Yeah, I think my general rule is there's that comma test that people have, and I have it too. Like when you take a comma out, then you put it back in again. Then you just have to show somebody because you can't decide. That's a real thing. You know. It's not just me. But with this book, but in general, I think when everything that had to happen has happened is my general rule. And so all the stuff I was planning for years and then executing and I was writing, when it all sort of comes together in that last 30-page section or 20-page section, or in this book, the last four pages, I think, are the best things I've ever written. I think they're really good. And so all of the years of thinking about it and the year of writing it sort of comes down to those four pages. And then everything that had to happen happened, and you can walk away for a little while before you start revising.
You have kids. The book is about a teenage girl. Did you talk about it with your daughter as you were writing? How do you explain?
Yeah, I mean, she picked up a galley, an advanced copy a few months ago. I was like, I'm gonna read it, Daddy. And I was like, well, you don't have to. And she got like a few pages in and hasn't mentioned it since. I think it was a little early. No, I know she would one day. It's much more dense than the stuff she usually reads. So I'm in no rush for her to come to it. She's only now realizing like what, a few years ago, she'd say, what do you do all day? Like, do you have a job? And I was like, I pay for things. You're eating my food that I bought for you. But she knows who Oprah is now, and I've taken her to interviews, stuff like that. I would say, I told her about Oprah, she's like, that's great. I told her about the New York Times review, that was good. She's like, that's great. And I was like, I'm going to BuzzFeed tomorrow. She's like, BuzzFeed? So it's sort of sinking in now.
So now maybe she'll finish the book. That and Oprah. Okay, so I have some questions from the audience. While researching and writing the book, did anything come up within you that surprised you? Anything new that you learned about yourself?
Well, I think, this is my eighth book, and then hopefully if you keep at something, you get better. I think Cora is well rendered, and I think it's coming from, this is my eighth, I mean, a lot of my other characters weren't well rendered, but I think I did a good job with Cora in terms of, so that's like the technical thing. Like, I think I did, waiting was good. I waited till I was like emotionally able and from a craft standpoint ready to do it. In terms of dealing with the material, stuff that came up, just horror and revulsion over the details of slavery, which we know, but then, reading first-person accounts, hundreds of them, really drives home the impossibility of the system. How did anybody survive? You just think, why do I even exist? Because the odds were so much against our survival, and I thank the nameless people who lived long enough, survived long enough to keep our family line going, I guess. Before I started writing, and I realized what I had to do to Cora, it was very hard. And then once I wrote the story of her grandmother, which opens the book, sort of a six-page biography of a slave from Africa to the plantation where she dies, the voice came very quickly, and I knew I could do it. And to get the characters on the page, you have to be in there with them, but you also have to be a part as a creator to shape the material. So you have to find that point where you're in this hell with them, but also you're standing it back as the God narrator, making a story that's coherent. So you find that place, and then hopefully the work where the work can actually live.
Okay. In light of current police encounters with African American youth, what did you discover about the origin of police in this country?
Sure. We say current, but it's always been rather the same. The last couple of years has been discussion about the talk that black parents give their kids. It's not something new. I got it as soon as I was over 5 feet tall. My father deemed that I was a target. And any encounter with the police, no matter how friendly, it could quickly escalate. And we watched a lot of instead of talking, we watched a lot of TV, and so I grew up on cable, and, you know, there's that famous Richard Pryor skit where he's pulled over, and he says, I am reaching into the glove compartment to get my license and registration. And I saw that, you know, that was my first introduction to being a black male in America as a Richard Pryor skit where the police aren't your friends. But so I've been asked a bit about like Ferguson and stuff like that. Before there was a police force in the South, there was a slave patrol, and the slave patrol could go to any plantation, any free black person's house, and search it, demand to see their papers. If you ran, you could be shot. If you weren't where you're supposed to be, if you were a runaway and didn't have your ID, taken to the jail, beaten, just as a matter of routine. And obviously, I didn't have the force parallels between the slave patroller's way of dealing with black people and what we call stop and frisk, which is really just walking while black. So current, it's not current, it's always. And the book is about slavery, and it's also about its reverberations through time to the present day.
There is a question here about David Bowie is in every about David Bowie and Prince, and I think you maybe mentioned in your acknowledgments that you always listen to David Bowie.
I do. Right? Yeah. Some people need quiet. I have always listened to loud music. I grew up in New York. There's always like a car alarm going off, someone screaming. So noise is company to me, and I love music. And so I have a loop of like, in the age of iTunes, a loop of like 2,000 songs, and it goes from David Bowie to like the Cramps to Ice Cube to Sonny Rollins, and I sing along. I'll take a dance break, but it's my company, and I've always always written to David Bowie, always written to Prince. Whenever I get to the last two pages of a book, I know I'm going to finish it this afternoon, I put on a Purple Rain and Daydream Nation back to back. And so whenever that sequence comes on, I'm like, all right, Colson, you did it. You know, you weren't hit by a bus before you finished. A bus is not going to come into the house. You just have two more hours of work. And so that's my victory music. You know, I did it once again. And so I put them in the acknowledgments because they've always been, them and many other people have always been like my sort of constant friends when I'm working.
I'm not sure. I think we probably have time for maybe one more. This is sort of a heavy one, but are you in favor of reparations?
Yeah, I guess I've been asked that. I'm used to not getting reparations because I did know in the void of my family history, my father would always talk about how his dad was a black Seminole and they don't really acknowledge black Seminoles. They don't get any casino money from the Seminole Nation. So I'm used to not getting my money from people. As a former freelancer, you know what that's like.
No reference.
So as a freelancer, you know, if the money comes, it's great. If it doesn't, there's not much you can do about it. So that's my idea about reparations.
That was like the speed round version of
sure.
of reparations. All right, well, I'll ask you one more then. How would you advise folks to tell real stories of slavery, given Snoop Dogg's statement that we don't need to talk about this subject? Snoop Dogg being the...
Yes. I was discussing this with Snoop the other day, his approach to history and mine. No one to know the past, you have to know the present, where we're going. I think how you talk about slavery specifically, when I was thinking about how to find models for the book, you know, sometimes you want to be spoiled by people, sometimes you don't, by other influences, but I was like, oh, I haven't read Beloved in 25 years. I haven't read The Known World by Edward Jones in 12 years, so I'll just read them. And so I started Beloved, and I got 30 pages in. And I was like, oh, I'm totally fucked. You know, Toni Morrison is the genius. So in terms of whether you're writing about slavery or war or family, in order to make it real, you just have to trust that you have something unique in your life to give to the subject. In all likelihood, someone smarter, more talented than you has tackled this subject. Are you going to have their voices in your head, or are you going to find that voice inside you that you can bring to the story of slavery, the story of American families, of poverty? So no matter what you're writing, what the subject, slavery or not, it's only going to work if you believe that you have something within you that is distinctive that you can add to the conversation. So.
Great. Well, I think Coulson is going to be outside to sign books.
And thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for coming.
And thanks so much for Joy.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.